Hello, Eugenie here. Today we speak with Peter Berryman, a man who is so highly qualified that he literally has more letters behind his name than in it. He has completed a Bachelor of Science Naturopathic Diploma, a Diploma of Astropsychology, a Bachelor of Medical Science, an Advanced Diploma in Homeopathy, a Postgrad Diploma in Health Science, Graduate Certificate in Education, and a Master of Science in Complementary Medicine. He has also taught at heaps of different colleges all across Australia and New Zealand, and currently as of mid-October 2021, he is the president of the Australian Traditional Medicine Society, which has a very long history here in Australia, and he's hoping to be re-elected in their upcoming elections. It's literally in the next few days. Voting finishes on the 27th of October 2021. So I was personally very grateful that I got to pick his brain a bit towards the end of this episode with some homeopathic questions that I have sometimes wondered about myself, and I feel like I learned so much during this episode. So just a note for the general public, or if you're new to homeopathy, it gets a little bit hairy towards the end. So if you have trouble keeping up with what Peter is saying, don't worry, the last bit is really aimed more at practitioners. So let's jump right into the interview.
Welcome to the Homeopathy Hangout podcast, where we discuss all things homeopathy from around the world. And now your host, Eugenie Kruger.
Hello, everyone, and a very warm welcome to Homeopathy Hangout. Today, we are hanging out with Peter Berryman, who has too many hats on and too many titles after his name for me to mention. So I will be doing a separate recording to actually add all of those, because he literally has more letters behind his name than in his name. So Peter Berryman, welcome.
Nice to be here, Eugenie. Thanks for inviting me.
Now, you are the current president of the Australian Traditional Medicines Association in Australia, with thousands of members and an incredible history. Can you tell us where your love for natural medicine first started?
I'm a third generation natural medicine practitioner, so it's been in my family, although arguably they have other disguises doing other things. Natural medicine has been in my family for a long time. It came about for me as an epiphany when I was the ripe old age of 14 years, and someone I cared a lot about got seriously ill. One of my colleagues at school, and she was taken to all the best practitioners, conventional doctors of the era in the time, and no one could help her. And I was distressed to think that someone I cared about was not able to be helped. And I made a personal life decision that I wanted to be that person who could help people who no one else could, the difficult clients. So I've had a quest to be the best physician I could possibly be. And then 2 years later, I finished high school, went to university, and my journey has been devoted to this ever since. So for the last 46 years, I've done nothing else but aspire to be the best physician I can be. So everything I've done, however variant it might look, are all intended to this one aim, to be the best physician I could possibly be. And I believe I've pretty much gotten there. I've learned a lot along the way. I've done all the training, a lot of courses, graduates from all sorts of universities and colleges and so forth, life experiences, travels, books and so forth, webinars, seminars. And that's why also I love training and teaching and passing on what I've learned to those who will replace me in the future.
Amazing. I wonder if you can maybe tell us a little bit more about what is exactly it is that you've studied, because as I was going through your CV and as we were chatting before the podcast, I was trying to comprehend how somebody can have done so much in one lifetime. Do you even remember all the places that you've studied at?
Well, I'm looking at my CV. I can't miss out on anything. But maybe if I just said I have my sun in Gemini, my moon in Sagittarius, my rising sign is Aquarius. So I am extraordinarily curious. I want to know, why is it so? And I've devoted that curiosity to the study of health and disease and humans and other species to be able to help people get better. And I've been practicing that for well over 30 years now as a graduate, specializing in homeopathy. I should say I'm fortunate to have been exposed to lots of different natural medicine modalities, And I considered being a jack of all trades, but I decided I wanted to master one. And I chose the one that I felt was the pick of the bunch, the best one, in my opinion, to devote myself to. And that's why I'm a homeopath.
Mm-hmm. So what specifically is it that gets you excited about homeopathy?
Well, it has the combination of recognizing and utilizing conventional Western science. So I've had a strong background in science, biology, medical science, graduating from Sydney University with a Bachelor of Medical Science, Auckland University with a postgraduate diploma in health science, Otago University with a Bachelor of Science, majoring in microbiology. And all of these things have been used to assist me in my gainful employment. I've been a senior lecturer in the bioscience department at a significant college here in Australia and in New Zealand as well. So utilizing that as a base point to then see, okay, well, yes, I understand this sort of mechanistic, reductionistic program of why it might be so. Is there more to it than that? And that's where I'm interested in psychology, in soul work, in counseling, psychotherapy. And the best model I found to help me with that has been astrology. So since I was 20, I've done formal studies in astrology, and I use that as a yardstick or a map to give me insights to ask the appropriate open questions for clients to help me understand their case. They might need a prompt on something that is embarrassing or shameful, hidden or forgotten. And I say, well, tell me about yada, yada, yada. And they go, oh, I wasn't going to tell you about that. Shoots out and away we go. Because, what's the cliche here? You are as well as your secrets.
Mm.
And you may not want to tell your secrets because they are often things that you are embarrassed or ashamed about. And in a case taking, we want to have an environment where a client feels comfortable enough to tell you what's important. And that's why I don't use intake forms. I just say, okay, so how can I help you today?
Mm-hmm.
Please talk about anything. If it's got to do with you, it's useful, it's relevant.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't force them to tell me about their menstrual cycle or their bowel defecation or their... If they want to tell me about that, that's fine. But if they want to tell me about their dreams or their fantasies or their whatever,
mm-hmm.
let's talk about that. Because if they are paying my fee and they want to talk about this, I'm happy to listen, because we do the best we can with what we've got, and we can never know everything. But if we give them the opportunity to speak and tell their truth, what they want to talk about, even if it's censored, even if I don't hear till three consultations. I had a client just yesterday. She told me something I wish I knew 30 years ago when I started treating her.
Oh, my gosh.
She didn't want to talk about having had a sexually transmitted infection 3 times,
mm-hmm.
which would have indicated a significant nosode like metarhinum,
mm-hmm.
which would have addressed what we call the obstacles to cure. So I've been bundling along, trying to make inroads in this case, quite frustrated. And now I know, after 30 years, oh, so that's the obstacle to cure. That's why some of my prescriptions haven't been as effective as I would have liked them to have been. And we get on. So, I mean, heck, clients, to be frank, sometimes lie to you.
Mm-hmm.
And you need to have enough clues to read clients.
And you find astrology is a good in for that.
And astrology is a good way to tell own body language. And these days we've got visuals. Once upon a time, I used to only work on the telephone with distant clients, let alone old school face-to-face. And I used to be able to try and make something out of intonation, how they said that word.
Mm.
I go, wow, okay, maybe there's something there.
Mm.
But now I can hear their intonation and I can see, okay, from waist up, I can see something, and it gives me a bit of clue, which is why I love doing house calls, house visits, because then I walk into their house and I see they've got a pet python. I wouldn't have known that if they'd come to my rooms.
Yeah, and they wouldn't necessarily have thought to tell you about it, but actually that can be a really good clue for you as to what remedy they need. And I just have to say, if you walked in on your first consult and never met you before and you told me the dirtiest, darkest secret of your life,
The only reaction I would have is excitement that it's going to be easier for me to help you. We are the least judgmental people on the planet as homeopaths because we hear so many different things. We're so aware that we are just here to help. We don't care if you have whatever you've done in your life. We just want to help you. That's the only reason why, you know, we need to know this information. So it's sad that it took her 30 years, but it's wonderful that she finally could tell you so that you can actually help her because that's all we're here to do.
Sure. Well, it's also why, particularly amongst British homeopaths, they have this thing called supervision, which particularly means you, the practitioner, take care of yourself by having somewhere for you to offload all those sad, horrible stories that you get told without you falling apart, listening to so much tragedy.
Absolutely.
That's once true. A month, go and get yourself sorted. Someone else, maybe another homeopath, could be a counselor or a psychologist. I mean, people who do counseling have this part of their self-help, their maintenance, their professional conduct is to get supervision. They stay well and don't crack up and don't burn out and don't crash and burn from all the tragedy they hear about.
Well, natural medicine in Australia is very, very lucky that you haven't kept all this incredible knowledge that you have all to yourself, because you have gone on to teach lots of homeopathy and to use your knowledge to help others. So can you tell us a little bit about all the places that you've taught and how you came to be the president of the Australian Traditional Medicine Society?
Thank you. Yes. After beginning my academic career at 16, Otago University, graduated, went on to do further study in Sydney, Australia, graduated with my naturopathic diploma in 1986, started practicing shortly after as a homeopath. I was fortunate that I had a bit of a reputation amongst my colleagues. I was known as a crazy mad homeopath. So a position became available at a teaching college in Sydney to teach homeopathy and supervise student clinic. So, in fact, even before I graduated, I was a clinic supervisor at Richard Kerr College because, gosh, I was a bit of a hotshot. And, you know, I believe in what I do so strongly. I'm very passionate about that. We've got, arguably, in my humble opinion, the most potent, effective therapeutic intervention available on the planet right now that is regularly available.
I completely agree.
And so,
hallelujah.
1990, I started my role as a teacher, trainer, and facilitator, clinic supervisor. I had multiple institutions in Sydney that I would teach at, ACNT, UTS, Nature Care College, Sydney College. And I would go over to New Zealand and teach for the Bay of Plenty College of Homeopathy as well at their Auckland campus. I started out doing postgraduate programs, but then I got invited to be their academic manager and was based in Tauranga for 2 years, teaching at all their campuses. But then I got headhunted to go back to Australia and got an academic position at the Endeavour College of Natural Health in their bioscience department. And I would be loaned to the homeopathic department as well to teach homeopathy and supervise student clinic on an as-need basis. And then that's gone on with, as I say, with Australis College and recently Switch On Health, an online college based out of Brisbane, where I live now.
Wonderful. Then how did you get on board with the Australian Traditional Medicine Society?
Okay. So while I was an employee at Endeavour College, a ATMS representative resigned and moved to another college. So they needed a representative from the college to go on the board of ATMS. So I volunteered. And that was in 2007. And so I've been on the board ever since. Then I was elected by the membership to be a what I call an ordinary director rather than an independent director since 2013. And since 2017, the board have elected me to be their president for the last 5 years.
And you've got an election coming up, I hear?
Yes. So every 3 years, the tenure expires of the current directors. So my 3-year tenure expires at the end of this calendar year. So I've been nominated to take another 3-year tenure if the membership deem it so. It's a democratic process. The elections are open right now through to the 27th of October. vote for Pedro. And there are six nominees, four positions vacant. I believe I've done a good job. I'm happy to continue to do so, both in governance, strategic planning, and risk management that I do as a director. Our committees, that's the workhorse of ATMS, is our seven committees devoted to a number of topics, reporting back to the board. I have a lot of passion and devotion and good ideas about what we can do as a team to improve the natural medicine landscape in Australia for all modalities, including homeopathy.
And ATMS has got thousands of members and it's been going for several decades. Do you want to tell us a little bit about the society itself?
Dorothy Hall, who was considered the grand old dame of Australian herbal medicine, started ATMS in 1984. And she set up standards of education. So we have industry standards, which are arguably independent of anything else anyone else does in the government or in other RTOs. And we've just grown and blossomed. We've got about 8,500 members across Australia in about 20 different modalities. Mm-hmm. So it keeps me universal because as crazy as I am about homeopathy, I'm very sympathetic that clients may find their niche with massage, reflexology, iridology, acupuncture, osteopathy, chiropractic. Heavens knows what might be the right thing for you. And therefore, I'm extremely tolerant of difference. So,
absolutely. We always need to have that choice for sure.
Yeah, because, you know, what happens to the failures? If the homeopath fails, where do we send them to? I send them to an acupuncturist or an osteopath or someone else. So they may be able to make a breakthrough if I fail.
Exactly. Can the general public sign up as a general member with ATMS as well, or is it just for professionals?
We do have a criteria called associate member, which is not a practicing member. So they can be a member of the public who just wants to support. They have a annual membership fee, so they don't get to vote in the elections, but they certainly can support us. We have an online Friends of ATMS as well, which is another network of folk who support us. They don't pay to do that. So there's two ways for the general public to become involved. We have an annual reach out to the public called Natural Medicine Week, usually at the end of May every year, where we get our members to host events in their private practice or these days with being doing things online. So online events and getting a lot of publicity using our own communication channels through social media to let folk know about the brilliant issues there are available in natural medicine, including homeopathy, all of them. So it might be a tea tasting, it might be seated massage complimentary. We had an expo in the Houses of Parliament in June. We petitioned the parliamentarians to have what's called a parliamentarian Friends of Complementary Medicine and Natural Therapies. So we went down and we booked part of the rooms in the Senate and we had an open day and we had parliamentarians, we had their staffers. We had the janitor come in.
Wow.
We did seated massage. We had videos. We did some testing, some functional testing. That's nutritionists know about that. And I was in charge of the tea table. And we spoke herbal tea preparations, a bit of this, a bit of that to help you with something simple. And
What was the reception like? Like
they loved it.
Really?
It was all free. Our sponsors helped cover the costs of, you know, what we were giving away and the teas we were giving away. But our lobbying endeavor here on behalf of ATMS and our membership is to improve the people who work at Parliament House. There are over 7,000 people per day work at Parliament House on an average day, to let them know what really is natural medicine, because they may have weird and crazy ideas about what it is and isn't. So if we can work from the janitor all the way up to the minister about what it is that we do and a little teaser of this and that, then when it comes to voting on critical issues like the entry report or finance issues or GST exemptions and sorts of things that we care about, we can feel as though we've made a little bit of difference in their awareness of what it is, rather than something skeptical or perverse even.
That's such a brilliant idea. Whoever came up with that idea deserves a gold medal. That was very smart.
It was one of the directors on the HMS board.
Brilliant.
Committee, and she's up for re-election, Christine Pope.
Excellent. It's wonderful just getting the person behind the therapy, or like you said, perverse even. I always laugh, but in Laurel Chaitin's documentary, Just One Drop, she asked people on the street, what do they think homeopathy is? And one guy says, oh, homeopathy is when you touch yourself in a weird way. People do think all sorts of weird things about natural medicine. So you guys actually going there and showing them what it is and getting them a taste of it. I think that's brilliant.
Sure. It's an extension of what we do with Natural Medicine Week. Mm-hmm. We do that in collaboration with other associations, and other associations are welcome to take this opportunity of going to Parliament House and utilizing this facility that we've got going. And, you know, we've got sympathizers to our senators, members of Parliament, ombudsmen, staffers, all the way down to people who sweep the floor at night. So
wonderful.
Want to make a difference.
Yeah. And actually, speaking of Just One Drop, I hope most of our regular listeners of this podcast have watched the documentary by now. Certainly, we've talked about the NHMRC report a few times. Jerry Dendrinos, in our second episode, kind of went into the whole NHMRC report and what that's meant for homeopathy in Australia. And that is still going on at the moment. And I know just the other day he had another meeting with the ombudsman, you know, just trying to get to the center of all of this. But when all of that happened, that NHMRC report, suddenly you could not study homeopathy in Australia anymore. And I think there's been about 3 or 4 years where there was nowhere in Australia where you could study homeopathy. And just recently, there is a school called Switched On Health, which received their registration with the ATMS. And I'm so excited that we can now study homeopathy in Australia again. So that's pretty amazing. Can you tell us a bit about that?
Yes. Once upon a time was a health training package for the 4 ingested modalities, including advanced diploma of homeopathy. That was cancelled in 2015. It was taught out by the end of 2018. And that leaves a significant hole in a potential pathway for potential students to be practitioners that they can't do an advanced diploma. Mm. So RTOs had to drop it, because they have this government mandate, and if the government has dropped the health training package, you can't teach the government program. So Switch On Health, Native Care College gone rogue. They've got a independent government-free program, as in not tied to government shoestrings and purse strings. So they can develop their own programs. They don't require government funding because the students have to pay. So there's gouging of weird things that happen about courses with students who are doing things for the wrong reasons and getting the money so that they're, you know, that's yucky. So Native Care College has got 3 or 4 programs now that are independent. Switch On Health has got 4 programs, including an advanced diploma in homeopathic practice that have been accredited with the ATMS standard of education necessary for those ingested modalities, including the ATMS minimum education standard for homeopathy, which we've had since 1984. I mean, it's been modified and improved, but we have an industry standard that is free of government input. It's what we think a homeopath should have,
which is way more important anyway, by the people, you know.
And Switch On Health and Nature College have delivered on that, and we welcome other RTOs to go the same way, because then they can untie themselves from the government. Now, we love the government, but sometimes they don't always act in our best interests. We love Greg Hunt, the current Minister of Health, to give us rebates back for private health insurance, and so on and so forth. So there's lots of things we would love them to do, but they can't.
No.
So do we sit and wait and twiddle our thumbs, and do we knock on the door and make appointments? Yes, we try. But if they don't want to do it, they don't do it. So we go independent. We encourage colleges like Switch On Health, Nature College, and any others who want to write a program, submit it to ATMS. We endorse it. Then you're an accredited ATMS education provider. There's an angle. You're not going to get students doing dodgy govy money, because they're going to have to be honest students who are paying for it properly. They get payment plans and help, but it's not government money. It's genuine students in a genuine course that is being genuinely accredited by ATMS. And we're not a kid on the block. We've been around since 1984. So I think we're credible. We're Australia's largest natural medicine multimodality association.
Amazing. I was so excited. The reason I found out, I told you, was that a client came to see me for her follow-up. Her son has autism, and I gave him some remedies, and she came back and he was doing so much better. And she said, "You have inspired me so much, and the results that I've seen in my son is so astounding that I have now decided to become a homeopath. And I found this great program from Switched On Health in Australia." And I was like, "Wait, what? I thought that we couldn't study in Australia." So when she told me that and I found out about the college, I was so excited. So I really applaud them, and I applaud you guys for giving them the registration, because we need more homeopaths desperately. My clinic is so busy. I now have two homeopaths on board to help me. They are getting booked out so quickly. And there's not that many homeopaths under 60 in Australia, worldwide actually, but I was talking about Australia. So we do need that new cohort of people coming in and learning about homeopathy to just really keep it alive and keep it going. And with the current pandemic, I think homeopathy is an excellent career choice, because we can do it all online and we can post your remedies out to you. So it's, I think it's a wonderful career choice.
Excellent. That's why I endorse Alistair Gray and Denise Streger's program out of New York, stroke world. Sort of, with online training these days, you don't have to live in a state capital city for a bricks and mortar college to see 9 to 5 Monday to Friday. You can do things, time zones permitting, any time of the day or night, with recordings, anytime, anywhere that suits you as a gray nomad or as an intellectual, you know, traveler. Mm-hmm. Of course, is while you're on the beach.
Absolutely.
So it's unstoppable now. So I'm glad these colleges are doing that, and encourage others to do that too. And ATMS has recognized, as leaders of the industry, that online training is the way to go. And we have appreciated the value of face-to-face training as well as online training. And so we've made significant landmarks as to, well, how much is okay and how much is not okay. And we're the leader of the pack. So we say more is okay than most other folk. Mm-hmm. So we're quite generous, quite liberal in that regard. So
Wonderful. It's
why folk like Martin at Switch On Health and the folk at Niche Care want to have their programs accredited. We don't register, we accredit programs so that they can be confident that their graduates will meet our standards and become members of ATMS, so that we can continue the chaperone process of encouraging graduates to excellence and be answerable to a code of conduct, and keep themselves from getting rusty with their continuing professional education program, make sure they are safe with the public liability insurance. Mm-hmm. The state, all those sorts of things, so that we can foster the next generation.
Absolutely. I wonder, Peter, would you mind sharing some cases from your clinic with us?
I'll tell you the gist of a simple case. A female client came to see me. On her left breast, she'd had a mole removed. And she didn't tell me how many times the mole had been removed. And I thought it might have been once or twice. So I gave her the well-indicated remedy. And the direction of cure was induced. 16 times this flared up and down, because she had had that mole removed 16 times.
Wow.
So when I saw the direction of cure induced, you know, the fourth component of the direction of cure is past unresolved problems come back in reverse chronological order. To see 16 flare-ups and settle and flare-up and settle and flare-up and settle, all as a consequence of this one remedy, I thought, oh my God. Mm-hmm. That's how it has to be, because if she's had 16 interferences and it requires 16 revisits to undo all that interference and non-curative action, I mean, surgeons have their place and I appreciate what they do, but it obviously had cured this issue of this mole on her breast. And not only did the mole on the breast change, but she went through a profound metamorphosis, and she remembered all sorts of unpleasant things. How her mother used to pimp her as a child.
Wow.
And so she had this, you know, healing process with her mother, and an incredible change. So it wasn't just about her breast, it was about the whole woman and where she come from. I'll give you one more quick case.
Please.
Female presented at age 27, but age 4, she had measles. And the measles, with its photophobia, it affected her eye, and she had one eye that turned. And the solution from the surgeons was a surgical correction to straightened her eyes up with spectacles. She had three surgical procedures on both eyes before I met her at 27. A simple prescription, never well since measles. You probably know the remedy.
Belladonna. Oh, pulsatilla.
I gave her pulsatilla. And what happened to her eyes? Three times they would flare up, settle down, flare up, settle down, flare up. The first time it happened, she was quite alarmed. But then I said, you've had this interference with your eyes. And she went to the Sydney Eye Hospital and they said, there's nothing going on there. I can't see anything. There's nothing acute. You haven't had a trauma. Mm-hmm. So we deduced it was a chronic regression. Then when it happened the second time and then the third time, we weren't so panicked because we said, oh, there we are. It's a curative response. You are resolving the interference of the surgical procedure on your eyes from the measles. And not only did her eyes correct and she never needed spectacles again, but the woman went through a metamorphosis. Her gut health improved. Her skin improved.
Wow.
She became more outgoing than introverted. The next family event was a wedding, and no one recognized it. Oh, who's that? Well, she's living down. She's got radiant skin. She's not got glasses on. She's out. Wow. Who would believe that was someone some time ago? So that's what healing is about. Mm-hmm. That's what I feel happens when you take a philosopher's stone.
Mm-hmm. Did you want to expand on that a bit more, the philosophy?
Well, I feel that what we do when we do homeopathy well is like what is rumored to happen when someone participates in the philosopher's stone, that is the therapeutic healing philosopher's stone. Now, there's a number of philosopher's stones. Some turn base metals into gold. I'm not talking about that. I mean, that's a metaphor as well. But the metaphor of taking someone who is ill, someone who is leaden, and turning them into gold, someone who is healthy and radiant and blossoming and well. That's what I think we do practicing medicine. Now, it happens in other areas of life, whether you're an engineer or an artist or a sportsman. They all have their similar aspirations, but we do it as health practitioners. We take someone who is ill and we assist them on the journey to getting better, to being mm-hmm. the best possible, given their age, socioeconomic position, gender and so forth, to be as well as can be. Mm-hmm. And that's what a homeopath does. And that's what the healing philosopher's stone does. So I've done some training in alchemy. In a sense, well, in case you didn't know, the curricula in alchemy includes astrology and a Jewish tradition called the Kabbalah and sacred geometry and all sorts of things. And we focus on the plant kingdom, the mineral kingdom, the animal kingdom. And we make things in the laboratory and it's amazing. And it's one of my quests to give back something to homeopathy is I'd like to see if we can make better, stronger, more potent, more effective medicines, particularly our plant medicines, which have been handicapped because the way that the existing homeopathic pharmacopoeia states a mother teacher is made is that something called the mark, which is the twiggy bits, are thrown out because they're not soluble in alcohol or water. And the mark is removed. It's not contributing to mother teacher. And this is called the body of the plant. The soul and the spirit of the plant are included, but it's lost its body. And that's, I feel, depreciated the potential of plant medicines being more powerful if their body was included. And a spagyric preparation is a mother teacher with the body of the plant included to give it more oomph than it had before we potentize it. So herbalists and homeopaths and anyone who uses plants as medicines, we could have better medicines if we included the mark. Now, what I'm talking about is what's a process called calcination. We burn the twiggy bits back to an ash. We separate the dangerous things, the carport mortem, the deadhead, the dangerous bits, and we have the water-soluble salts, usually potassium and sodium salts, and put them back in with the liquid alcohol and water-soluble parts, the oils and the alcohols, which are reflective of the soul and the spirit. So the body is added back, and then we use that as a mother tincture. If we potentized it into centesimal, decimal, Q-scale potencies, we would have more potent medicines than we already have. And already, these are pretty fantastic. But for our difficult clients, and my stock client is a difficult, complex, chronic client. I mean, that's the niche of homeopaths. Mm-hmm. We get all the difficult ones. Mm-hmm. And to move those clients forward, we need excellence. So we do our best in terms of philosophy and theory and case taking and case analysis. Sometimes what lets us down is the pedigree of the medicine. It wasn't made to the very best possible pharmacopeia standard. So it's one of my aspirations is to improve the homeopathic pharmacopeia standard to make better medicines before they potentize. So we have more power available to us, particularly for our difficult clients. So I can't remember About 20 years ago, I had a yoga teacher said she wanted to come in for a general checkup. That was the last easy client I had. I don't get easy clients. I get difficult, very difficult, from preconception, fertility, and fertility issues through pregnancy, delivery. My sister's a midwife, so I've had something to do with home birthing and birthing.
Wow.
Pediatrics through teens, all the difficult puberty through fertility.
So you obviously like a challenge.
Yes, and as well.
Yeah.
Yes, and one of my other pet topics, along with, as I say, this idea of renovating homeopathic pharmacopoeia, also has to do with how we get the second half of the prescription correct. Now, there's been so much focus in homeopathy about the right remedy, the similar one. Yes, but we have to get the optimal potency as well. And that's another one of my favorite pet topics. I've written extensively about that. And I'm an advocate now about Fibonacci series homeochords of either centesimal potencies or Q potencies. And heck, why not even decimal potencies? And making those into the homeochord is where you put the multiple potencies into one bottle of the one remedy. Then the client will self-select what they need and not select what they don't need. And they tend to have, therefore, less aggravations. And then when their needs change, whatever their new need is in there already as well. So you don't need to change potencies because the different potencies are in there and they just work their way around whatever they need.
Dr. Joe will be very happy to hear you say that.
Strong advocate for Dr. Joe. And also my myth busting, this idea that posology has been hung up and obstructed on the idea between these alleged high and low potencies. And I've written about how there is no such thing. There's a paradox that is simplified into a half truth about high and low potencies, but they don't tell you the other half of the truth that paradoxically says, well, actually, that's not quite correct. So this is the sine wave idea rather than a linear up or a linear down.
We'll give a warning to the general public. I have a feeling we're going to get into the nitty-gritty of things right now, but I would love us to go here because many of my mums are becoming such great home prescribers. So I reckon let's rev it up a gear. Let's change things up because this podcast has only ever been done for people of the general public, but we're going to be revving up things a little bit and chat to us about potency purely for my own selfish reasons because that's something I often struggle with. You know, finding the remedy out of 8,000 odd remedies is hard. But next thing is potency, and that's a whole other story. So, Peter, you've got the floor. Go for it.
All right. Well, homeopaths have to do two things right. Select the right remedy and give it an optimum potency. And if we've done both of those right, how we know we've done it right is the direction of cure is induced. So there are so many guidelines around how to find the similimum, the right remedy. I'm not going to go into that. But what I can offer you is that I have suggested a solution to the other half of the prescription, the posology, the potency, the dosing issue. That once you found the similimum, then you put into one bottle in the centesimal scale, each of the Fibonacci potencies, starting with 3C, just to avoid some of the gross toxicologic problems of 2C, 1C, and mother teacher. So there's 3C, 5C, and up to 243C go into one bottle. And then the client picks their dose from that. And for an average chronic client, it might be 5 drops in the mouth. It's 5 times between doses a day, every day, till the next review, which might be in a week or a month. I mean, a bottle on that sort of regime, 25 ml drop a bottle, will last about 4 weeks.
Mm.
So at the latest, speak again in 4 weeks, if not sooner, and see how they go. And what you would expect, had you got the right remedy with this and this, the other half of the posology optimal dose issue, what people call a minimum dose, the client should be making some excellent progress in accordance to the direction of cure. And if they want to express it as a percentage and say, I've had 5, 10, 20, 50% progress since starting, then you've got a quick feedback. Well, okay, so I got the remedy right. The potency was in there. They got the optimum dose they needed. They made this progress and keep on sailing on until they reach either the point of cure and they're sorted, discharged, or if they're not and they're on some plateau below cure, then we need to revise, perhaps review, maybe change the remedy and continue on again. So what I'm suggesting is this is a solution that is not addressed in the literature and hardly anyone's got their mind around it. Joe's got an idea. An author in 2012 called Michelle Shine had a crack at it, but she got hung up. She didn't get over this issue of high and low. So she clung on to this idea that there are high and low potencies. There's not. And attempted to address this issue, which is not possible. So if we could get over this myth of high and low and address that any potency could be an optimum potency, if that's the client's optimum potency individualized for their needs, then we don't have to get hung up on, you know, 3C is a low potency and 10M is a high potency. Because if we appreciate the sine wave, those different potencies may be at the same point on the sine wave delivering the same therapeutic intervention, and we've given them the wrong name. And we see if we see things from left to right rather than up and down, high and low. Because, look, here's the basic idea. Hahnemann said, I want medicines to be rapid and gentle. And if we do that, then we get a curative response, a permanent curative response. So how do we deliver rapid? Sakasha or trituration, right? And so we have in our potentizing process a step-by-step process, and it's why it's called intercurrent succussion, because we do a phase of diluting, and we dilute by a ratio of either 1 in 10, 1 in 100, or 1 in 50,000. And then we stop, and then we do some shaking, and we can shake 2 times, 10 times, 100 times. Again, the ratio differs according to the scale, and we keep on going. Students, practitioners query, well, what potency should I use? Well, here's my answer. A Fibonacci home accord of all of those Fibonacci potencies, say the simple scale or the Q scale, or heck, why not even the decimal X scale into one bottle and deliver. So then there's only one thing to get right, and that's the right remedy, which is hard enough. But I'm making it relatively easy then if you get the right remedy. And I've solved the posology problem. Everything should come true from that.
I like what you're saying. So as you were saying this, I thought I'm going to throw another sticky question your way. Is I think it was Laurel Chaitin, that filmmaker of Just One Drop in our podcast, was saying, you know, she just wishes homeopaths would prescribe a bit more consistently. And I said, well, I actually like that we don't, because we're all so different. But I feel like we have an explosion in homeopathy of different prescribing methods and different ways of analyzing the case. Do you give just one remedy or do you give 10 different remedies? Do you give an organ support or do you like how, what do you think is the answer to that? Should we all prescribe exactly the same way or is it good that we're all different? And what does that mean for the public who want to go see a homeopath? Maybe have previously seen one who just gave them one remedy. Now they go to somebody else and they walk away with 10. What do you have to say about that?
This is potentially highly confusing because, there's an author who wrote a book on 17 different ways of being a homeopath, all these different methodologies. And arguably, they all have a time and a place. There's a...
Was that Ian Watson?
Methodologies of homeopathy.
Yeah, that was one of my textbooks.
Yeah. So reading that, you get an idea, gosh, there are so many ways that you can call yourself a homeopath and do something very different from someone else who calls himself a homeopath. And again, because I'm into inclusivism, rather than the opposite, I'd say, well, look, if you're getting a curative response, if you're inducing the direction of cure, who am I to say you're wrong? And who am I to say that I'm right and you're wrong? Because my path is being evolutionary, and things I do now, I never dreamt of. I taught myself new tricks that no one taught me, and I would have never dreamed of them. So these things I pass on to my students and in my writings, because I want to leave a legacy to help those behind that. So I told you some of these ideas about having a home accord, having multiple potencies in one bottle. I've tipped on this idea of having a spagyric tincture of a plant as your starting product before you potentize it. This idea of solving the myth of high and low potencies. There's a paradox of a sine wave that as you go from left to right across a scale, it simultaneously gets stronger and weaker and stronger and weaker and stronger and weaker as you go across, because we are simultaneously doing dilution and succussion. So we get weaker by dilution and stronger by succussion, weaker by dilution, stronger by succussion. You get the idea. So it goes, so it doesn't, it's not linear of one or the other. It goes up and down like a sine wave with peaks and troughs. I've got evidence to suggest that that's the case from people like quoted from Bovinist and from Jones and Jacobs and so on, other authors who show this non-linearity of different potencies having different biological effects. So if I can solve all these sorts of things, then why can't I entertain novel ideas from the latest? I mean, heck, let's admit it, there are fashions in homeopathy. And, you know, the epicenter of international homeopathy rotates. And there was a time it was in the United States, and then it moved to the United Kingdom, and then it's moved to
India,
Holland and India. And heck, why can't it be in Australia?
Yeah, why not? I'm ready for it. So that leading on then, what would you say to a member of the general public who is thinking of seeing a homeopath and might be wondering how that person might prescribe, or if they walk away confused? So I'll give you an example. I have a client over here. I use several remedies in my prescriptions, organ supports and endocrine sarcos and balnozos and homeopathic detox therapy and constitutional remedies. She then sent her member of her family who lives in Ireland to see a homeopath, and that person walked away with one remedy. So she was very confused. So what would you say to a member of the general public who's thinking of seeing a homeopath?
Well, their choice in a homeopath is probably the most important decision they will make, because if they choose to work with you, Eugenie, or me, Peter, they have to shop around and say, well, you know, I phoned them up, or I saw them on a webinar, or they're advertising or whatever. And you need to feel comfortable with your practitioner to be able to tell them what you probably might even tell your partner. So many clients have said, not even my partner knows this about me. Telling you. So it's that element of trust and confidentiality that you need to have a special sacred place for them to talk. Because if they can tell you what you need to know, then you can truly help them. And this particularly goes for men, adult men. So stuck at talking, you know, they come in and say, I'm here because she sent me, my partner, my wife, my girlfriend. And she's the problem, really. Nothing to do with me. And how long before I can go? Yeah. So we need to have tricks and tools to deal with clients, or clients who can't speak English, or clients who are young or elderly, so on. So case taking is so important. So, but I think some of the rationale for these multiplicity the methodologies, Eugenie, has got to do with fear. And unfortunately, many homeopaths are fearful of doing too much. It's the aggravation. And some teachers way back, I don't know when, did some harm to someone and have perpetuated this fear that has emasculated many a homeopath. And we are so fearful of overwhelming our clients, we do the opposite. We make the mistake of having unfavorite remedies and unfavorite potencies and unfavorite methodologies. That diminishes us. I mean, look, I don't want to advocate killing clients, but we would get a little more respect if we had a few more nasty issues. I don't want those, because it's not desirable. So a lot of these methodology variations and techniques and Isiaga levels and French homeopathy is all about trying to avoid an aggravation. And if you can do that with a well-selected semilimum, given in an optimum potency, and that's just one bottle, that's good enough. But if you can't do that, or that's too challenging or too difficult, and there's so many layers and it's so complicated, you might end up with a lesional remedy and a fundamental remedy and a miasmatic remedy and a constitutional remedy, all in the same package, trying to diffuse a bomb.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's got to do with how you're trained, what your attitude is, how good and strong your philosophy is, how well you understand your client. And all of that often comes down into your business plan. Are you dictated in your time by dollars? You know, if you've got a 7.5 minute consultation because you need that throughput of clients, as GPs do, it's going to dictate how they do their work. You want one simple problem, one simple prescription, next, next, next. It's on throughput. Whereas as a homeopath, we typically give clients lots of time. An hour and a half is not an unusual first consultation for an adult client. A walking away with one remedy, it's not an unusual prescription of the Fibonacci home accord or the semimol. And for me, that is frequently enough. Now, clients unfold, secrets come out, layers peel off, changes are necessary. I've told you some of those ideas. I've written about them as well. So you can see how things unfold and how the caterpillar turns into the butterfly. We need to follow along. So, you know, there's horses for courses. There are times when I need to draw on the periodic table to inspire me to an element, or using similar ideas in botany with family and miasms, so forth. So, but to a new student, that ends up just being far too
very confusing. Yeah, definitely.
Because, you know, the school of training says, well, we have to expose them to all those ideas, but in doing so, they lose the plot. So they need something very simple. So I know some training courses in the UK, they say, well, we're only going to teach you homeopathy up to about the 1960s. That's your undergraduate program. If you want to know any new homeopathy since the 1960s, you're going to have to do a postgraduate program.
That's actually a good idea. Because I feel if I was taught everything that I know now at college, I would have given up because I would have been so overwhelmed.
That's right. Because then the new graduate says, oh my God, there's so much I don't know. I've heard all of this. Whereas if you had one simple, reliable technique, heck, you know, there's been a resurgence in the Bonninghausen method, the Baron. And that might be a good place to start. They teach that in German universities and the medical schools to their students. Some very simple. And they can do that. If they do that well, that's a great start.
They can still get great results. Absolutely. So I reckon, Peter, we should end up on a little bit of fun. And I'm going to ask you your top three homeopathic remedies that you personally can't live without and why.
Well, you're asking me to fall into the trap of having favorite and non-favorite. I'm acknowledging the philosophical trap you're endorsing. So here goes. I've only got one, and it's the one that I think is the closest to the homeopathic philosophy stone for healing. Okay. So arguably you don't need anything else. It's the guy's name in Melbourne who runs a homeopathic course. Yes, facial diagnosis. He has colors associated to the major miasms. He has yellow fossora, red psychosis, and
I know the one you're meaning. I can't
think.
Yes.
Right? And then the mixing of those three primary colors, you get the other colors. Okay. So if you mix the three primary colors, you get brown. Okay, so brown has red, yellow, and blue in it. So that's why I'm starting a simple, I won't give you the whole argument, but simple argument for why a medicine nicknamed brown is the most repulsive thing you could think of as what the alchemists call your prima materia. So alchemists who heard this thought, oh, it's going to be feces, or it's going to be urine. That's the most repulsive thing I can think of, shit and poo, and wheat. Well, there's something I can think of these days that would be potentially more repulsive than urine and feces, and that's cancer. That's brown. So carcinosin, carcinosinum.
Yeah.
Most people know of it as the breast epithelioma from St. Bart's Hospital in the UK, but there is tenus Smith's version, which is a T58 rather than a T1.
So 58 tumors, hey?
58 different tumors. Fibonacci series and Sintestin scale of T58 carcinosin brown.
Okay, I will be calling Mike at Similimum and ordering that. You have me sold. I do love carcinosin. It's the one remedy that I have prescribed probably hundreds of times over the past decade, and I've never had an aggravation from it. I love that remedy so much.
Well, this is to avoid an aggravation. This is how to avoid all those other...
Yeah.
Having lesions.
In a Fibonacci cord.
Those odes and...
Love it.
So we get away from that French Asiago stuff. Mm-hmm. This is the bomb.
Mm-hmm. And excellent.
And in case... Okay, one more thing. One more tip as to why this might be so special is if you know about physiology and the cell cycle, you've heard of telomeres and telomere shortening as to how you get to the Hayflick limit and why cells have planned senescence called apoptosis after 50 to 70 cycles of reproduction. And that's what death by old age is. You have enough critical cells dying in a critical organ that the organ fails and you fail, and then 115, you die. That's when you're supposed to die. Okay, so that happens because telomeres shorten. Now, telomeres in the cancer cell do not shorten. They have upregulated telomerase, the enzyme that keeps the telomeres from shortening. So they have physical immortality. In case you already know, cancer cells have physical immortality. So one of the characteristics alluded to about the Philosopher's Stone is it will give you physical immortality. Well, I'm not going to suggest you get physical immortality. Otherwise, we'd be having 100-year-old people hanging out, and we're already overpopulated with people. But I think what the appropriate philosophical approach is, we will get you to 115, and then you could have a critical organ failure, and then you could expire by old age. And if you die before 115, you've shortchanged yourself through whatever. Mm-hmm. So there's something about cancer, and it's is physical immortality that will engender physical immortality in you or our clients, not literally, but figuratively, to the point of getting to the Hayflick limit at 115.
Well, my mind is blown, Peter. We had like a solid half an hour chat before I started recording because you were just blowing my mind. And I was like, okay, we are going to have to start recording because you have got so much good stuff that you are just sharing so, you know, graciously with all of us. I appreciate it so much. I just want to thank you for your time. And I feel like my mind has been blown after this podcast.
Probably.
I can't wait for us to chat again.
That's why I'm so passionate about education, my professional development, and passing that on as an educator, as a facilitator to the students I've ever been involved with, and why you should vote Pedro and get me on as an ATMS director and potential executive president, etc.
Excellent. Thank you so much. Have a wonderful day.
Thank you. Bye, Eugene.
Bye.
Hi, homies. There are two incredibly exciting courses coming up that I want to share with you and for which I've managed to secure an awesome discount. The first course is with Anke Zimmermann, who featured on episode 38 of the show. And the second course is with Giovanna Franklin, who featured on episodes 103 and 146. Let me tell you a bit about Anke's course. It's for professional homeopaths who are interested in helping children affected by autism and related developmental challenges, as well as dedicated autism parents with a strong background in homeopathy. The six-month course starts October 7th and will run once a month on Saturdays from 10 till 3 Pacific time, live online, and sessions will also be recorded. Anke will present live cases for intakes and follow-ups to teach the careful case management needed for these complex children. Anke is also using integrated protocols including classical homeopathy, tautopathy, homeopathic detox, organ support, and related approaches for best results. So if you would like to learn from one of the world's leading homeopaths with 32 years of experience specializing in autism and related challenges, then you can find out more information at www.ankezimmermann.net. You can email Anke through her website and use the code HOMIES to get a $100 discount. So that's ANKEZIMMERMANN.net. The second course I want to share with you is Giovanna Franklin's new course called Gemstone Remedies for the Aquarian Age. It's a unique course that combines in-depth teaching of gemstone remedies and astrology. Homeopaths Giovanna Franklin and evolutionary astrologer Brian Coulter will run 12 live monthly sessions from September 2023 until August 2024. And all listeners of the Homeopathy Hangout podcast will receive a $10 discount. For further information on the course program, contact Giovanna at info@homeopathyheal.co.uk. That's homeopathy, HEAL.co.uk. The Homeopathy Hangout podcast will receive a small commission for each sign up, which will help me to pay for my amazing editor who puts so much work into editing the episodes, uploading them, writing show notes, and so much more. Thanks for your time.